there at full volume.
What? No, Molly said. That's crazy. You jump out from here, and you'll die on that thing for sure.
I can float, Prone said in its droning electronic voice. Heights hold little danger for me.
And if the Guardian knocks you away? Molly asked.
Do we have any other choice, Molly Patel?
Maybe we can keep it distracted, Bakar said. Buy you time. Get close enough to get its attention, but not so close it attacks.
That sounds like a wonderful plan to me, Gadam said.
Kareem nodded in agreement.
I think I can work with that.
He was continuing his slow plummet to the top of the Guardian. Soon it would be only 100 meters away. At this distance, all they could see in the viewport was the construct.
Very well, Prone said.
But if you find it preparing to release another blast to shut off the power again, you must flee as far as possible and immediately land on the ground. This will be its first strategy once it regains control over its primary defenses. With that, Prone edged to the bay and floated out the back of the Pelican. Within seconds, the winds had carried him completely out of view. Bakar dashed to the back of the Pelican and slapped the bay door's release. The ship's hydraulics whined as they drew the ramp up again. The silence and stillness that came after that didn't last for long.
Okay, hold on, everyone, Kareem shouted from the cockpit. I'm going to make sure the Guardian can't miss us.
With that, he throttled the Pelican into a steep dive that angled wide of the Guardian by a scant 100 meters. Just as they were passing by the construct's stern face, Kareem began pulling up and winding toward the right to circle around it. He gave the Guardian a wide berth, but kept close enough so that he could veer toward the machine, or away from it at any instant. The light inside the Guardian grew stronger than ever, and Molly wondered if maybe Kareem had miscalculated. If the Guardian let loose with a blast now, it might knock Prone to drift too far away to reach it in time. Molly shaded her eyes with her hand as she peered through the upper viewport at the space just above the Guardian's head. The Hurrigok looked like nothing more than a fleshy balloon falling down through the sky, waving his tentacles slowly as he went. She worried that he might live up to his name and drift completely off course, if he was indeed prone to that, but he did not waver once in his path.
"Prone is in!" Molly shouted as the Hurrigok successfully slid between some of the floating parts near the Guardian's head.
Everyone in the Pelican let out a long-held breath.
"How long do we think he's going to take to do this?" Kareem asked.
"Hopefully not too long," Molly said.
"Why?"
"Because the Guardian looks like it's gearing up to do something."
She saw that the Guardian was slowly gathering energy toward the tips of its enormous wings, and a glowing blue sphere was forming at the machine's center. Molly recognized it at the same time as Bakar. This was precisely what Prone had warned them about. The Guardian was going to release another pulse and send the Pelican crashing into the ground.
"Dive for the surface," Bakar shouted. "We must land now."
Kareem didn't waste any time asking why. He nosed the Pelican straight down for Trevelyan far below, and they dropped faster than a stone.
"What's going on?"
Gadam shouted as they all clutched at grips on the walls, trying not to get thrown around by the dropship's momentum.
"The Guardian is about to shut down all power again," Molly said. "It must have detected Prone inside it, trying to disable it. Maybe it decided this is the only way to get at him."
"That's not going to stop him," Gadam said.
"Will it?"
"Who knows," Kareem said. "But it'll get us for sure. And as high up as we still are."
"Go, go, go,"
Gadam shouted, now catching Kareem's meaning.
"Less talk, more move."
Molly watched the ground get closer and closer, and she wondered if maybe Kareem hadn't misjudged this entirely. At the speed they were going, if he didn't pull up in time, they were going to wind up splattered all over the research facility.
"At least it'll be a quick end," she thought to herself. "Maybe not entirely painless, but quick."
Gadam started screaming, and Molly joined her. A moment later, even Kareem pitched in, hauling up on the controls as hard as he could. Bakar didn't make a sound,
But Molly could see the terror etched on his face. Molly was sure they were all going to die. But then, something amazing happened.
Kareem yanked up the pelican's nose at a horrifying angle that nearly tossed her to the ship's floor.
Molly felt them hit something hard, and the entire dropship violently jarred up and back, tumbling over what must have been a tower.
This sent most of them rolling to the back end of the craft, where Molly bumped hard against something, and then scraped along something even harder.
By looking through the front viewport, Molly could tell the pelican was spinning, nose to tail. Trevelyan flashed out of view, and the sky and guardian high above came into it. That's when she saw the blue light held by the Forerunner construct finally burst, sending out an instantaneous wave in every direction. The power left the ship entirely. It felt as if the pelican's cords had been cut, and its nose now spun toward the ground again as the vehicle dropped straight down. Fortunately, the pelican's first impact had brought them surprisingly close to the surface. The pelican hit the ground on its belly and continued to spin laterally. As the viewport came into focus again, Molly saw that Kareem had found a wide-open landing strip, and the now powerless craft was chaotically careening along it, scraping and skittering across its pavement as it ground toward a halt. After a long, loud, screeching moment, they finally came to rest. They'd all fallen silent, most of them having screamed themselves out of breath. For a moment, they simply stared at one another in astonishment. They were still alive. They began to cheer, but Molly cut them off. Looking up through the cockpit's viewport, she had one huge question that still hadn't been answered. What happens if Prone disables the Guardian and it comes down? Everyone else fell silent. Where will it land? She had been so preoccupied with stopping the Guardian that she had avoided considering the collateral cost. The Guardian had to wind up somewhere when it fell. What kind of damage would it cause, and who might be underneath it when it all came crashing down? There's nothing we can do about that now, Bakar said. The protocol in an emergency like this would require evacuation from the area. Hopefully everyone obeyed.
We didn't have a choice, did we? Molly asked. If we didn't do this, 1,000 worse things could have happened. This was our only chance. If Prone even succeeds...
As the words left her mouth, the first piece of the Guardian came crashing to the ground from its tail section. Then another. And another. The gravity that held the ancient machine together had been disabled, no doubt by Prone. When the first piece smashed into the ground behind Trevelyan's complex of buildings, Molly didn't see it so much as felt it, like a short but violent earthquake, followed by a series of tremors for each additional segment. The rest of the construct came hailing down from the sky soon after that, cascading piece by piece. Some small, and others unimaginably large. Each of them slammed into the ground with the force of an explosion, sending up clouds of dirt and debris, knocking down buildings and other structures, some only a few hundred meters away. Soon the dust and ash from this bombardment spread like a blanket of darkness and choked the air, billowing outward as it swallowed up all of Trevelyan, including the landing strip they'd narrowly made it to. As the smoke enveloped the cockpit of the pelican, Molly looked around at the others. My friends, she thought with a smile. They were filthy, tired, and beaten up pretty bad. But somehow, they had survived.
Chapter 37 Molly's new parents just about killed her. She couldn't blame them. She and her friends had put themselves into mortal danger, after all. More than once. As was suggested to her countless times over the next few days, if she and her friends had just stayed where they had been told to, they wouldn't have wound up risking death. Which was all true. But as Molly was quick to point out, if she had done that,
then Dural would have killed Bakar. The Guardian would have conquered Trevelyan and Paxopolis. And a lot of other people would have died. There wasn't really any way to argue against that. And Molly's new parents didn't press the issue too hard. They were alive. She was alive. They all had a lot to be thankful for. After the Guardian came crashing to the ground, prone to drift, floated down from the sky on his own. Rattled, but safe. In all the confusion afterward, and the thick clouds of dust, no one could find the Haragok for a while. But he showed up back at the security facilities in Trevelyan the next day, much to everyone's relief. A lot of damage had been done to both the city and the research complex, including to many of the people who lived there. From the initial strike against the Guardian by Trevelyan's local battle group to the Guardian's catastrophic destruction, large swaths of the UNSC outpost had been leveled. Many people had died during the attack. But Asha pointed out that it was only a handful compared to what their losses could have been. Asha and Young had been coming back from the excavation site when the Guardian first rose, and they had been completely clear of the initial destruction. They had wound up locked in a powered-down tram for the duration of the event. It would take a week for the power to be fully restored to the city and all of its research sites. Several dozen soldiers had been killed in the battle with the Forerunner soldiers and the Sangheili warriors that had raided both Paxopolis and Trevelyan, and the UNSC's survivors spent a few days mopping up what remained of those threats. The distant sounds of firefights and skirmishes braced the nights that followed, but Molly still felt safe throughout. The most dangerous moments were already long past. They could start to breathe easy, at least, even as they began to count and mourn their losses. Bakar had lost his brother. No matter how horrible Dural might have been, that still hurt him, and Molly could tell it was not easy. But questions still remained. Oni sent a number of strike teams out to recover the bodies of Dural and the rest of the servants who'd been with him. But they only located a handful. In addition, they couldn't find the rest of the servants who had invaded Paxopolis, which meant they had to still be somewhere inside Onyx. When the bulk of Dural's invasion force had retreated through the portal in the middle of the city, though, they'd locked it down and covered their heads. Oni had no idea where the servants were and how many had survived. Still, Director Barton vowed that he would not rest until his forces found the servants of the Abiding Truth and secured the research facility and the city. The main challenge for those inside Onyx was that they were now on their own, completely out of contact with the outside galaxy. Trying to call for help from inside the sphere was deemed too risky, especially given the reports they had first received about what was happening on the outside. Evidently, Cortana was winning. But Onyx was tucked away inside the folds of slipspace, well beyond the reach of any outside threats. At least for now. As soon as a squad of Marines at the spaceport had found Molly and her friends trapped in the Pelican, they'd broken their way in and pulled them free. They'd put Lucy on an evac skiff and taken her immediately to the hospital. And to Molly's relief, they'd already found Tom at the repository. When things finally started to get back to normal, Director Mendez stopped by Molly's house with an update. Kasha, Tom, and Lucy were all doing well and would heal up fine, thanks in large part to the incredible technology available at the local hospital. Lucy might have a bit of a limp for a while, but Mendez told Molly, given everything she's been through already in her life, if that's all she has to complain about, I'd count myself lucky. Kareem's mom was absolutely thrilled to have him back home. She cried so hard. Molly thought she was going to join her. Gadam's parents, Mama Afrid, Mama Beskin, and Papa Marfo, smothered her with love when she came home. The other kids from her family paraded around as proud of her as if she'd single-handedly saved the day. That made Gadam grin, although Molly knew she couldn't imagine having done it without her friends. Molly thought they might not let Gadam ever leave home again.
but she was back in school when it reopened 2 weeks later. Of everyone, Bakar probably had the most challenging time readjusting. Most of the Sangheili in their local keep were not pleased to discover that he was really Asim Ndama, nephew to Jewel Ndama, who had done so much harm to their people. Once Kashah Hylot had fully recovered, she took great pains to explain to everyone the events surrounding Bakar's placement within the Arbiter's clan. Bakar's actions had already more than proved that he was no friend of Jewel Ndama's covenant, or the servants of the Abiding Truth. Eventually, the other Sangheili came to see that. As for Molly, she spent most of her time recovering at home while the school was being repaired. Asha and Yong joined her, since much of their work was on hold for the moment, too. They would no doubt return to analyzing the Guardians soon enough, but not until Oni had cleared some of the debris from its demise away. A few days after the Guardian had been destroyed, Molly's family hosted an old-fashioned Wisconsin cookout for all of their friends. It was the first time her family had done this in years, and for Molly and her friends in Paxopolis, it marked the beginning of a new chapter. Not only did it give them an opportunity to celebrate having braved a terrible storm together, but it also gave them a chance to look forward with renewed courage. Who knew what the future held for them? All that Molly was sure of was that she now had friends she could count on, no matter how bad it got. That seemed like enough. "We have no idea how long we're going to be locked down here inside the slipspace enclosure," Yong said. "That means no one coming in and no one going out. But since we're all going to be stuck in here together, I think we need to make every effort to ensure we all get along. Sometimes that requires extreme measures. Like a neighborhood-sized Wisconsin cookout, don't you think?" Molly recognized that something had changed in her heart since she arrived here. All of the grief from what she'd experienced back on Paris 4 was still there, even if weaker on some days than others. But instead of resenting the species that had destroyed her family in the war, she could now see and embrace each person as an individual. All the differences that had made her scared of or angry at such people before now seemed insignificant compared to what had united them. Bakar and Kashah were the last guests to leave that night, and Molly was determined to give Bakar a hug just as he walked out the door. The Sangheili only hesitated for a second before he hugged her back. She didn't know what it took for a Sangheili to hug a human, but she was glad that it now came easy for her to embrace Bakar. They were allies for certain, but they were also friends. As Molly was cleaning up, Asha came over and gave her a tight hug, too, and then a lingering kiss on the top of her head. "What's that for?" Molly asked. Asha dabbed away a tear welling in her eye and smiled at Molly. "For giving me hope." Epilogue. "Duralam Dama!" Those were the last words to leave Kernik's mouth before the Pale Blade slammed what remained of his battered and sputtering energy sword into Kernik's throat. Dural had not bound up his broken leg with what he could scavenge and limped all the way back to base to open a discussion with the cowardly traitor. There would be no mercy, and no second chances. The only thing he deserved for his treachery was death, and Dural happily handed it to him. The Pale Blade walked into the base after 3 days in the wilderness, and he could see that Kernik had already proven a disappointment. No one had challenged Dural. They had simply stepped aside and gazed at him in surprise and awe, as he slowly made his way up into the cathedral's central spire, found Kernik, and put an end to him. Once the deed was done, Dural turned to his surviving commanders and brandished his blade before them. They looked as if they had seen a ghost. "Do any of the rest of you have the courage to defy me? Do you?" Few of them could even meet his eyes. Dural had worried that they might look upon his injuries and refuse to accept him as their leader. But his brash disposal of Kernik seemed to have persuaded them
that he was up to the job. Arkit, one of Dural's personal vanguard, stepped forward and gently put his hands on Dural as if to make sure that he was not actually a spirit.
"You were dead, Paleblade," Arkit said,
his voice raw with astonishment.
"I saw the creature carry you off with my own eyes.
I rode that animal until it fell over lifeless, bleeding to death by my own hand."
Dural gazed at his mauled fist, still clutching the sword.
"And then I came back here to punish this coward, who thought it wise to attack me from behind."
Dural glared at them all, baring his teeth to display his disdain.
"We just dealt the humans a terrible blow. But instead of pressing our advantage, you've given them the time to recover and fortify. Now they will be on the hunt for us. And what have you done to prepare for it when it comes?"
No one had a decent answer. No one but the Hurrigok, even Keel. The creature floated forward to make its report, and Dural gladly let it approach. As it did, he saw reflected in the others its instant recognition of him as the leader of the servants of the abiding truth. They knew that without Dural, their lives here would soon come to an end.
"I see you have gotten the power in the cathedral running again," Dural told it. "What is the status of our vehicles and heavy weaponry?"
"Inoperable," Keel said flatly through his collar. "The other leader took me off that task and set me to another." Dural snorted at that.
"He is gone. I am the leader here again."
Keel wobbled in the air before it spoke. "The other leader wanted us to flee the shield world. But the entire place has been encased inside a slipspace enclosure. We are cut off from the rest of the galaxy."
"What? How?"
"The humans here ordered this done as a means of isolating the shield world from the enemies who threatened us all with the Guardian."
"Can you undo this?"
The Hurrigok rolled from side to side. "Perhaps. But to do so would be to invite the Guardians back in. They would attempt to stop any conflict to maintain peace inside the shield world. They would use any means necessary, including destroying the servants of the abiding truth."
"So we are trapped here."
Dural scowled at his commanders. He held them all responsible for not doing something to stop this from happening before it was too late. At the very least, they could have redoubled their efforts to take control of the human settlement. Instead, they had retreated and lost the second Hurrigok. Keel nodded. "However, I have succeeded at my latest task. I have discovered a far better location for your base." Dural narrowed his eyes at the creature. Perhaps Kernik had not been entirely useless after all.
"Where is this?"
"On the third planet that orbits the shield world's interior sun. The humans call it Macintosh. There is an installation there which serves as the home port for a Forerunner warship."
Dural gaped at the Hurrigok. To think that they could have such a vessel at their command. Perhaps it could house his entire force. "Is it operational?"
"It has not been moved for many millennia. It may require work to restore it to its full use. But it is habitable and accessible through the portal network. There are substantial provisions there, and armaments as well."
"That shall be good enough. For now."
Dural stepped out onto the parapet to address his warriors. Word of his return had already spread quickly through the base, and they had now gathered around the spire to learn what would become of him.
"Servants of the abiding truth, I am your leader once more."
A roar of approval rose from the assembled crowd. The commanders behind him wisely echoed it. The challenges posed by Burren, Rook, and Kernik had not proved pointless. They had been necessary, and indeed appointed by the gods, so that Dural's present leadership would be solidified. Even Dural's encounter with Asim echoed of this design. Dural could now see that this was how events had needed to transpire,
for the servants to thrive in the wake of Avum-Med-Telkam's death. Now that Dural had emerged from the crucible of betrayal alive and full of fury, the Pale Blade could accomplish the task the Fieldmaster had delivered to him. The Covenant, even the scraps of which had survived to this day, has now been completely destroyed. The Arbiter likely rules uncontested over all of Sanghelios. Only one thing stands between him and utter victory over our people. The servants of the abiding truth. I promise this, brothers. If you submit to my leadership and are loyal to the abiding truth, we shall taste victory together. We shall stand strong against him and his human allies. We shall make him regret his spurning of the gods. We shall amass our divine instruments of vengeance, and we shall take Sanghelios back once again. The servants roared their approval. They too wanted blood for all that the Arbiter had taken from them, and they saw the Pale Blade as the one who could give it to them. You may have heard that we have been cut off from the rest of the galaxy. This is true. The humans did this in a desperate effort to protect themselves. What they do not realize yet is that they have given us the chance we need. The time and space we require to build anew our forces and our armament. Soon we will have the resources we need to purge them from this shield world and claim it as our own. We are not trapped inside this world with them. They are trapped in here with us.
Duro's warriors thrust their weapons high and roared in unity. As their accolades echoed throughout the spire, Dural turned to Even Keel and his commanders and said, "What are you waiting for? Make all the necessary preparations. We move tonight."
Halo, Legacy of Onyx, was written by Matt Forbeck and read by Scott Brick. Kamchatka, music from Halo 5 Guardians, was composed by Kazuma Junouchi. The associate producer was Michael Noble. Editing and post-production by Fenn Eichner. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Halo, Legacy of Onyx, is available in print from Gallery Books. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Halo, Envoy, written by Tobias S. Bakel and read by Scott Brick. And Halo, Retribution, written by Troy Denning and read by Scott Brick.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.